Hey.
Thanks for hosting.
Absolutely. This is very exciting. Today we are going to do an Ask Me Anything with Professor Richard Salzman. He is a professor of economics at Duke. He is the author of the newly published Where Have All the Capitalists Gone? I'm going to put that in our pinned link. And he is also teaching at the Atlas Society Morals in Markets. It is a seminar monthly for students and young graduates, but we also make it available as a downloadable podcast. So I highly recommend that you check it out. So today we are going to do an Ask Me Anything. If you guys have questions, then go ahead, raise your hand, and we will get you up here. We also have a backlog of questions from our 63,000 Instagram followers. So we'll add a few of those into the mix if we have time. I'd also like to make a request of all of you. We did this yesterday and it helped out a lot. If you can share this room, you can go up to the upper right-hand side of your screen, the three dots. I'll give you an option to share whether you are on Facebook or Twitter or whatever social platform. It's a way to make sure that we can have more people have access to the incredible wisdom of Professor Salzman. So we are going to get started. We're also going to be recording this. So, and we will make it available on our podcast platform as well. So, we got a question here from Lawrence.
Yes, hello. Thank you for hosting this. Richard, my question for you sort of comes to this question of morals when it comes to economics. So, we hear a lot in the news right now about how there are sanctions being imposed, government doing these mass things of who you can and cannot trade with due to the situation between Ukraine and Russia. Now, taking that aside and looking purely from a moral perspective, isn't there something that we should be concerned about when governments are telling you who you can or cannot trade with? Or are there certain exceptions to that rule?
That's a great question. I do have a view on this. I believe that the role, this won't sound like economics in the beginning, but I believe one of the proper roles of the State Department or any kind of foreign ministry is to constantly monitor and create lists of, call it, friends and foes. If a state doesn't know this, it's not a very good state. And the U.S. State Department does have this. You know, Iran, for example, would be an obvious case. Now, there'd have to be principles involved with this. You know, what makes another country a foe? They can't be perfectly, you know, behaved. They can't just mimic our own system, even if our own system was perfect. But this principle, Lawrence, I think, of coming up with objective criteria for saying other states are allies of ours versus enemies or mortal enemies. I think in the case of the Soviet Union from 1917 to 1991 was a case of this, although FDR recognized the Soviet Union as legitimate in 1933. So, I mean, I would have opposed that. But the reason I say all this is once that is done, I do think it is proper for a government then to go and say to private businesses and individuals, you cannot trade with the enemy. But you realize it really has to be principled and thought out, and everybody has to know who the enemies are and what the reasons are. Allies, of course, are in a different situation. Now, in a case where there are aggressions that occur, you know, unexpectedly, you would still have this list, right? But others might make the list. Like, suppose someone was not on the list, but then they joined. Well, let's use a case where suppose China was not on that list, or Russia in the most recent case, right? If they join an enemy like Iran, then we can immediately declare that they're hostile to us. You know, so any kind of axis, any kind of alliance that moves a country from you know, not enemy to helping enemy, same thing could happen. So I gather from what you're asking is something like, well, shouldn't a free economy be a free economy? Why have sanctions at all? Why should the government be able to say who you can or cannot trade with? But I go on the principle that if the government's proper function and purpose is to, well, if its proper purpose is to protect individual rights, one of the functions is national security, and this would be one of the ways to carry it out. I hope that helps. More could be said, but...
Thank you.
Okay.
The great Roger is in the room and on the stage. Roger, always love having you in our rooms. You asked great questions, and I know you had many yesterday, one of which you were able to ask to Stephen. I'm not sure if you got the answer you wanted. I think you did, but maybe you have another one you want to hit Richard up with.
Yeah, I guess my question for Richard would be based on, you know, where we're at right now with, you know, we came out of pandemic. There's war in Europe. There's inflation going on. Do you have any good news for us? Like for those of us that are looking for a silver lining in terms of, you know, an economic like hopefulness. What can you point us to, and like how far away are we from you know, from being prosperous again in a sense of as a country?
Well, Roger, the good question. I think one thing I would say is just looking at the last 2 years of what I consider to be a horrendous violation of individual liberties and ridiculous non-science lockdowns and massive deficit spending and all that kind of thing. I think one bit of good news that I would point to is how amazingly resilient the American economy is. Now, that may not be saying much, but when you think about it, the unemployment rate has come back down. Now, granted, a lot of people aren't working, but the downturn in output was fairly short. It was steep, but it was fairly short in 2020 when they shut everything down. And so just the resiliency of it, even though all these interventions are occurring and even though there's reckless fiscal spending, but of course, those are all the bad news things you yourself mentioned. But that kind of resiliency is sometimes underappreciated and underrecognized. And the question is, where does it come from? It's still a mixed system. And so it's part nutrition, part poison. The capitalist elements are the nutritious growing, you know, life enhancing stuff. And that we can be thankful that the freer elements of our system are so resilient to all sorts of injections and infections. And I'm using it metaphorically here of statism. Maybe building off of that, are people recognizing that what I call Faucism, which is the fascism of the public health idiots, it was a major mistake. I do see the beginnings of that recognition. I'm hoping that it leads to something like never again. I'm not sure that'll be the case, but we really have to get to a point of never again. Never again will we let public health officials, you know, myopically focus on that one thing to the destruction of almost everything else, including mental health, not just investment portfolio wealth and stuff. And I guess the last, not to go on too long, regarding war. Now, you mentioned the pandemic, war, inflation. Let me just say something quickly about inflation. I'm encouraged so far that the inflation is largely being attributed to the government. That isn't an obvious thing. If you remember from the 70s, they immediately went to oil companies, OPEC, greedy labor unions, and what did we get? Price controls. So you get price controls, which are really terrible for a capitalist system, when the culprit isn't identified accurately. You know, in the 70s, they were blaming the messenger, the price setters, not the Federal Reserve and the Treasury for going off the gold standard. I look around today, and even though there's widespread economic ignorance, I do, unless I'm looking at narrow sources, I do see people saying, not quite carefully enough, but they're saying the government did it. Either the Federal Reserve did it, or all this deficit spending is doing it. The government spending, to, you know, that's the cause of inflation. That's a very good sign. Now, the inflation isn't a good thing, but the recognition of what caused it is a good thing, because if people really hate inflation, as I think they do, they see the cost of living go up. If they get the right culprit, they'll start asking or demanding that that culprit behave itself. So there's some glimmer that a cure will be had instead of making it worse with price controls. On the war, again, bad as it may be, I don't think it's as bad as people think. But the good news here, I think, and I think Professor Hicks alluded to this yesterday, that there's a principle in political science and in history called the capitalist peace. And the capitalist peace is academics noticing that wars are not started by free or freer, more capitalist, more democratic, if you will, countries. They tend to be initiated by brutish, semi-socialist, semi-fascist regimes. And that's happened again here. I would actually say both Ukraine and Russia are corrupt. People are glorifying Ukraine now. Ukraine's as corrupt as the Soviet Union, if you look at the measures of it, and their economy isn't much freer. But again, you got two brutish, brawling brothers, in effect, in that region of the world. And I think it makes us look good, so much for the claim that capitalism is the aggressive, imperialistic system. No, that other system is. So those are the three things I'd name if I'm looking for silver linings.
I'd add to that that we've seen an increased adoption in platforms and technologies that help us to communicate and trade. So, 3 years ago, there were still a lot of people say, I'm not going to do, a Zoom, or I'm against technology, or I'm a Luddite. You don't hear many people saying that anymore. They've gotten over the hump. They've joined the 21st century. I also agree with Richard in terms of politically awareness that a lot of people who were just not interested in politics didn't affect them. And the lockdowns and mandates show that it does affect them, that it was shocking what government can do to us. And so I think that might have contributed to a political alignment. I also can say that at the Atlas Society, we've seen an enormous growth in our community over the past 2 years. And part of that has just been the work that we've been doing for the past 30. But I think that people are animated. They are angry. They are alert to the fact that these problems were caused by bad philosophy, by bad premises, and they're searching for answers, and we have them. So,
we might add also the recognition in schooling and education that it should be privatized. That's not widely believed, but the movement toward homeschooling, alternative, just exposing these school boards and how badly kids are treated and taught with CRT and everything, that is much more widely known now. So that could be a silver lining, too, to the extent people are trying to correct that corrupt system.
Great point, Richard. Huge increase in homeschooling over the past 2 years, and a big move in the needle in terms of support for school choice. So
yeah,
all good things. And I think it's important to, with gratitude as a theme here at the Atlas Society, it's not, meant as a kind of a Hallmark card sentiment, but as an objectivist virtue of giving yourself some ballast, of finding those things that are working for you, that are strengthening you, so that you don't give in to despair and a feeling of hopelessness. So it's a very practical virtue to gain strength and launch yourself into making your life better. So, Mark, thanks for joining us.
Well, hi, everybody. Hey, I've got a quick question here. Now, it seems to me that the typical features of libertarianism, like freedom, individual responsibility, low government, I don't think there's enough people who directly resonate with that message in society to create a winning party, a governing party. I mean, there are lots of people that do, but not nearly enough. So my question is, what could be missing with the brand of libertarianism that's, you know, untapped, that's either missing, it's wrong, or it's just altogether not even being addressed, where the majority of the population would want to be libertarians, even though there's very few people that would actually resonate with your actual, you know, features? Is that type of thing talked about?
Good question. The first thing I would note is that in terms of electoral success, the best thing that could be done is to change one of the parties, not to form a or expect to have success from a third party. The U.S. system is just built for having two parties, and when there are various technical reasons for that. It's not just ideological. But that makes third parties very difficult to form and to win. But we have seen historically parties change by, call it infiltration of either better or worse ideas. For example, I would say the Democratic Party is getting worse. I'm not sure the Republican Party is getting better, but I would pick the Republicans. I've been a long time Republican. I've never been an independent, and I'm very anguished about where the Republican Party goes, but I'm thinking of them as the most likely to be pro-capitalist. So, Mark, my answer would be to get libertarian / objectivist ideas, policies into the Republican Party, make the Republican Party better. I would classify the Republican Party, by the way, as just being anti-stuff, and that's defensive. So they're anti-Democrats. They used to be anti-Soviet. They used to be anti-liberal media and press. They need to be pro-capitalist. Now, that's radical, obviously, to say that. Some of them don't even want to use the word. But they have to have a forward-looking and active agenda that says, you know, not when Donald Trump said, America will never become a socialist country. Very nice sentiment, but we need a Republican president who says America must become a capitalist country again. I think the best, and the Republican Party, by the way, should look at itself as having a very honored and noble history and lineage, especially versus the Democrats going back to the Lincoln, going back to the founding of the party as a one-issue party to abolish slavery, and having people like Lincoln, Coolidge, and Reagan. But another way of looking at this is that the American people love still, I believe, the founding fathers. Now, which one you pick as a favorite? My favorite is Hamilton. I know others want Jefferson, but just in general, the founding fathers were libertarians for all intents and purposes. They were classical liberals. So that's a building block as well. And notice, by the way, the left wants to totally, and they have for years, besmirch the image and the names, reputation of the founders to eviscerate the Constitution that they gave us, to pack the court, to get rid of the Electoral College, all this kind of stuff, to make America a pure democracy, meaning a pure mob rule. And most Americans don't like that. So I'm not as pessimistic as a libertarian might be about, you know, the electoral success of these ideas. I just wouldn't go with a libertarian party. I think they've demonstrated since 1972 when they started that they've had no success whatever. But I don't think it's because the American people don't want liberty. That would be my answer to that question. I hope that helps, Mark.
Yeah, I guess the only thing I'd have to say is that even never mind whether it's a libertarian party or a conservative party, the thing that gets me is that these features that we're talking about freedom, if they become popular and the majority of the people want to vote for that, it can be stolen by anybody. It can be stolen by Democrats. Democrats could just put their thumb in the air and say, oh, we're freedom, you know, and they can get all their people like that. So I guess my question is, what is the, and this may not have an answer, it may just be something to think about and just go on from here.
Yeah.
But basically, what is the brand that can never be stolen as opposed to features? You know?
Well, you mentioned as stolen. I mean, if we had two parties, you know, clamoring to be the Liberty Party, I don't think that's a problem. We need them competing to say we're more for liberty than anyone, but they don't, neither of them are really advocating that. One wants complete equality, or what they call equity. And the Republicans almost never say liberty, except maybe for Cruz and Senator Paul and Senator Mike Lee. There's only like three senators who even talk this way on the Republican side. But the other thing I would stress is that this argument has to be on the ground of morals. It isn't just leave me free, but that leave me free to pursue my rational self-interest. You know, you can't tell me what to do. I'm my own person, individualism. So sometimes libertarians downplay the underlying moral principles that underlie liberty because they want a big tent. And that doesn't work. It hasn't worked for a long time. So, and of course, it goes without saying, I think, that no libertarian who flirts with anarchy can get anywhere, because we're talking about political parties, we're talking about electoral success, and you just shoot yourself in the foot if you start with, you know, the state is evil, but let me be in charge of it. That makes no sense. So the whole wing of the Republican Libertarian Party, I don't know how big it is, that is for anarchy, isn't going to help either. And the American people do have a feel like when they hear libertarian, they say, oh, those anarchists, that's a problem. Or that they're into minor issues like, you know, drug legalization, not the big issues that people care about.
Okay, I'll just put a link into a message to you showing what I think is a brand.
Great. Thank you, Mark.
Abby.
Yeah. Hi, Richard. I know, I think I saw that you were maybe on the current events webinar with us yesterday.
Yes.
I don't know if you got to hear much of that, but
I did.
Okay, good. So you're going to kind of know what I'm talking about. There was a lot of talk. There was talk about capitalist peace theory, as you mentioned, and then also what I would call maybe a sort of broad support for the U.S. role in NATO. And I think, you know, as a younger person who has no, you know, memory of sort of the Soviet Union or the Cold War, sometimes our generation questions the U.S. outstated role in NATO and, you know, how much we put up most of the funding and most of the troops. And I guess I'm looking for your thoughts on what our role should be and what we should demand of our allies in the future if we stay in the NATO alliance.
Well, that's a good question. And notice it goes back to the issue earlier of how to identify friends and foes and who are allies and who are not. NATO was formed after World War II as a group of nations, mostly backed by the U.S., to stand up against the Soviet Union and its satellites, and that was called the Warsaw Pact on the other side. So the Soviet Union plus 12 or 15 satellites were the Warsaw Pact. Now, what's odd is the U.S. won the Cold War. It's just undeniable. Reagan and Thatcher and Mulroney called them the neoliberals, won the Cold War, shocked the hell out of the left and the Soviet Union. And so you could argue that for all intents and purposes at that point, now maybe it should have taken a couple of years, both the Warsaw Pact and NATO should have been unwound, reduced. The threat was gone. The Warsaw Pact did go away, but it had to go away because the Soviet Union went away. And all those Eastern European countries that were in the Warsaw Pact, you know, we all remember, if we're old enough, they all had their own independence movements. They all started establishing freer systems. The world got more peaceful. It was wonderful. So the 90s were a great decade, precisely because the Soviet Union was no longer a threat. But I have to say, the U.S. went back on its word, and NATO went back on its word. It did promise the ex-Soviets that they didn't promise to unwind NATO, although the Russians and others said, unwind NATO. We don't want to feel like there's a military threat on our borders. But short of that, NATO said, we will at least not expand eastward. Now, what does that mean? That it would have stopped it at where it was, Britain, France, Germany. And instead, there was, if you look it up, NATO expansion. And this is, again, not to have a brief for Putin, but one of the legitimate things he's actually been saying since the 2007 Munich speech is NATO is expanding toward me. And I don't like it. I don't want NATO on my border. It's almost like when Kennedy said, I don't want Soviets in Cuba. Now, I know there's a moral difference between the U.S. and Russia. I'm not trying to draw out moral equivalence here, but NATO has expanded. They've added, I don't know, 15 countries. And the most recent, Ukraine was trying to get in. So you know, Poland is in, which is just to the left, just to the west of Ukraine. So Abby, I think more philosophically, so I think this is a problem with, I am not a big advocate of the U.S. propping up and being the biggest player in NATO. I believe truly sovereign countries should be grown-ups with their own military. And what they're really doing is outsourcing their military to the U.S. taxpayer. It's outrageous. There's nothing in the U.S. Constitution that says the U.S. government has to provide national defense to places like Estonia or Poland or Bulgaria. It's just ridiculous. It's not proper. But you can have alliances. I don't have any problem with the U.S. having alliances with countries that are allies and might need help against foes. But the idea of hundreds of thousands of U.S. troops permanently stationed in places like South Korea and Poland and elsewhere, to me, is an abomination. It's just improper. And by the way, it just makes all those other countries like children, like dependent on U.S. military. So when shit goes down, they have nothing. I mean, look at how pathetic the Ukrainian military is. They're literally putting guns in the hands of, you know, teachers and gas station attendants and bakers and stuff. I mean, it's criminal that a country like Ukraine would not have developed, sitting right on the edge of Russia with this maniac threatening them for decades, would not develop a military defense. It's ridiculous. What's it got to do with the U.S.? I think there's too many people in the U.S. at the Pentagon and elsewhere who like this setup. They love the idea that they can be a military all over the world and be a quote-unquote policeman of the world. But if you look at how many jobs they have botched in Iraq, in Libya, in Egypt, it's incredible. They can't even beat the Taliban. It is out 20 years and the Pentagon could not defeat a ragtag group of cave dwellers called the Taliban. And then they left all the military equipment in their hands in Afghanistan. This is a U.S. that's going to take on Russia. It's ridiculous. I'll stop there before I lose my temper.
Thank you, Richard. That was a very good answer.
I have yet to see Richard lose his temper. All right. We will try not to make you too mad. I'm going to get to Nate next. We have had a few more people join. Again, favor to ask. For those who haven't done it yet, be awesome if you could share the room. Just you can do that with the three dots at the top right hand of your screen, and let's get some more company. Nate.
Hi, thanks. Hi, Richard.
Hi, Nate.
Appreciate you being here and speaking with us. I have two questions, and I'll give you the option on which one you want to answer. You don't have to answer both, but I would say, could you give me either your best debunking of modern monetary theory or your best debunking of the labor theory of value?
Well, how about both of them very quickly? Sure. The labor theory of value, which was held unfortunately by the great Adam Smith in The Wealth of Nations, 1776, the guy who kicked off the field of political economy. It's basically the idea that the economic value of goods is determined by the quantity of labor that goes into making the goods. And not just that, it emphasizes manual labor. It emphasizes muscles. So if you get that, and Marx took this over, of course, and said, wow, Adam Smith is right, but you shouldn't be free market about this. I too believe in the labor theory of value. I'm speaking like Marx now, but I see that there's exploitation because who gets best paid? Who gets compensated most? Not the physical laborer, but the skilled laborer, you know, the one that can use tools, or the mental, cerebral labor that goes on, you know, when an entrepreneur is running a business or when a financier like J.P. Morgan is financing those businesses. So this labor theory of value leads people to believe that anything beyond physical labor or the sheer quantity of labor put into the is exploitation, is a ripoff of manual labor. The positive argument against it, of course, is that wealth is primarily an intellectual thing, that wealth is created by the mind, by the creative mind, not by muscle. The world has seen eons of muscle without much wealth being created. Not until the Renaissance and the Enlightenment liberated the human mind did we get the Industrial Revolution, the Scientific Revolution, indeed the political revolutions of America and elsewhere. So it's still out there today. The labor theory of value is not really taught as legitimate in universities, thankfully, except by a few Marxists. But it is still in some policy, like the minimum wage law is an example of why some people still believe in the labor theory of value. It's in that law. Modern monetary theory says that a government can create money and debt almost without limit, without cost. That's the best summary I can give to you. But it means now money supply would be, what would be the effect of too much money? High inflation. And what would be the effect of too much borrowing? Very high interest rates. So the last time we saw very high interest rates and very high inflation, like double-digit forms, was 1970s. I attribute that to the world going off the gold standard in 1971. But these modern monetary theorists have been able to point, Nate, in recent years to, well, look, there's been massive money creation and no great inflation. And look, there's been massive government borrowing. U.S. national debt's now $30 trillion, and interest rates are still low. See, so on a superficial level, it seems plausible to them that you can do this. But modern monetary theory is not modern. It's a leftover, actually, from the early Keynesian and even earlier than that, what used to be called monetary cranks, people who thought prosperity could be had by just printing money. And they're almost 100% behind the idea of the big state. They're statist through and through. None of them are free market types. So what they're looking for is a way to finance the welfare state, the burgeoning welfare state, without taxation. Because taxation would throw you out of office, right? And there'd be tax revolts, things like that, right? So instead of taxes, they're trying to say, no, print the money and borrow it. Don't tax people, print the money and borrow it. And if you see any inflation, then tax people, because it sounds like they have too much money to spend. So I hope that helps.
Appreciate it, Richard. Thank you.
You're welcome. You're welcome, Nate. Thanks.
All right. So I'm going to use my moderating prerogative here to jump the line a little bit, because we have my dear friend and friend of the Atlas Society, Dale, up on stage. We rarely have that treat. So Dale, do you have a question for Professor Salzman?
Yes. You know, I'm an older guy, a boomer. And, you know, I remember when I was at a very leftist university in the 70s, you know, there was debate and concern about, you know, the very small, budget deficits that we were running, the national debt. And, you know, now it's like nobody's talking about this. Neither party is talking about it. And then along with that, we have the looming crises in Social Security and Medicare. They're running out of money. And, you know, how do we wake up people it's like an abstraction. You try to talk to people about this and they just don't understand. So that's just my question. How do we wake people up? Because I am so concerned about this and the burden we're leaving for younger people.
Dale, it's a good question. And I puzzle with this myself because within economics, my specialty is what's called public finance. So anything dealing with spending, taxes, borrowing, government debt, the Federal Reserve, monetizing debt and all that kind of thing. This is probably one of the more abstract areas of economics. So one of the challenges, and when you scratch your head and say why people don't care about, sometimes their eyes just glaze over. They have no idea what a budget deficit is versus a debt versus, you know, when is debt too much? When do governments default? When do they not default? You know, if you ask the average person what the Federal Reserve is and what it does, they have no idea. I even university students I find very smart are clueless about this stuff. So part of it is they're not being educated as to what's going on. But the other thing is the politics of it is just, and I come back to this theme a lot, and I mentioned it earlier, the welfare state is unsustainable. It just is. It's not. It's a system of almost, I would put it as democracy out of control. People just voting away the wealth and rights of other people and being told that they can do it without cost. And the key is, the real key, and this is why both sides won't go there, is you cannot, in a democracy like that, raise taxes because people will throw you out. So what is left? They want the spending. They don't want the taxing. The only other two methods for the government to get its hands on any money is to print it or borrow it. And that's why the printing and the borrowing are skyrocketing. Now, if I were to say, Dale, well, you know, if we had sky high interest rates and, you know, people taking out mortgages at 20%, which you'll remember that from their 1980, right? or if they were facing 14, 15, 16% inflation, you know, would it be easier to say to them, see, the welfare state's going bankrupt. This is terrible. I'm not sure I'd want to wish that on the economy, but that is ultimately what's going to happen. Either those rates and inflation will skyrocket, or they'll just be a flat-out default, certainly on things like Social Security and Medicare, things that are unfunded. They'll just renege on those obligations. But I think another way of looking at this would be, and again, this is somewhat technical, when interest rates get so low and then sometimes go negative, I mean, think of that. The government borrows and it's not paying you an interest rate at all. That to me is a kind of default. You know, they don't technically not pay the interest, but the interest is so ridiculously low, it's as if they're borrowing without paying you. So it is, we are seeing what I call an implicit default on the U.S. debt. And one last thing I would say, Japan is a good leading indicator of what this might look like. Now, if you ask people, how's Japan doing? Japan did not collapse and fall into the ocean with their massive government spending and money printing. They've just stagnated. They've literally not grown at all, that economy, its productive capacity, for 30 years. And the population is getting older. And they're losing all their vitality, and that's where the U.S. could go. It's not so much a story of things blowing up and systems crashing and things like that, but a long, prolonged stagnation where nobody sees living standards going up, and if anything, they're going down, and then lifespans go down, and then people's expectations of whether they'll be better off than their parents goes down. All those, the kind of the American dream going sour, and then it's just an issue of whether people figure out what the cause is or not. I hope that helps.
All right. We have our founder, David Kelly, in the room. David, you want to chime in? But I warn you, I might be asking you about Popper and Kuhn. Go ahead and unmute yourself. There you go.
I had a question, a point about Ukraine, but we're well past that, and I don't want to belabor the point. But you can ask me about Popper anytime. Seriously. I'm going to let Richard go forward on with the questions he's got on economics.
Okay. All right. Well, I'll call you afterwards, as always.
Okay.
Scott.
Thank you. Thanks for doing this, Richard. You know, I saw something about whether Republicans should run on something specific or just run on not being Democrats. And, you know, there's kind of debate in the Senate between Rick Scott and McConnell on that. But I'm just curious from your perspective, if there's one or two issues that you think might be good to push from a liberty perspective for people running for Congress or statewide office this year?
Well, I'm not sure I have much on that. Looking a little longer term, I think the most important thing is to privatize the schools and get some more intellectual diversity in the universities. Now, that's not necessarily a political platform thing, but that is really the root of all these other bad ideas and policies. So, but the main thing is that I think the Republicans have to start speaking of a system that they consider ideal and work toward that. They're totally defensive now, but a whole bunch of things need to be privatized. That was a dirty word when Thatcher tried it, but you did succeed. And it's, you know, you say, listen, this is capitalism has to be private ownership and control of the means of production. And we're losing that all over the place. So any kind of plan that moves us in that direction is a good thing.
Thanks, Richard. Roger.
Hey, thanks. Hey, I had to jump in. I just want to say, you know, I I hope one day I'd have enough time to talk about modern monetary theory and labor theory of value. And I'm not going to do it right now. And the way I've formulated the question is, what would you consider is the fair distribution of surplus? On the one hand, you could have like one person deciding who gets it all and that determine what's fair. On the other side, you could just say surplus exists and everybody fights to the death for it. And so the question is, do you think surplus is fairly distributed now? And if it's not, how do you think, what do you think, what measures should be in place that would distribute surplus fairly?
Well, if by surplus you mean net production, it's distributed unfairly now because it's redistributed by the state. It's not left to the private market to decide what people's marginal productive contributions are. The capitalist defense of income and wealth should be, first, it should be free voluntary exchange. Then when you look at disparate effects and differential income, as long as there's voluntary exchange, it's due to productive capacities being different. The wealthy, you know, short of things like estates, it comes from people contributing more to production, creating more value than others do. So to me, that's fair. If it comes out that the top 1%, you know, earn 30% of the income, so what? The key is earn. They earned it. They didn't steal it. So that the critique of inequality, you know, looks at overall income, wealth creation, profits, and then sees it as a kind of pie and then says, well, where should these pieces of pie go? And if they're not the kind of pie slices I like, then I think the whole system is unfair. But the current system is so mixed and so distorted by redistribution that I would say that itself is unfair. That when you see, as we do today, you know, the top 1% who earn, say, 30% of the income, paying 70% of the taxes, the idea that the rich are not paying their fair share, they're paying way more than they should. There should be a flat tax. If there's any kind of tax, there should be a flat tax, not this punitive graduated income tax we have. So I hear from what you're saying that it's more of a kind of, not to just label it, but a more Marxist kind of leftist critique. Even the word surplus is the kind of word that an anti-capitalist would use to say, you know, this is made by labor and then taken by others who didn't labor. And isn't that unfair? And what should we do about it? That thinking is what's given us the current system, which is so unjust. So we need to go back to a system where people earn, even if differential wealth, because they've done it voluntarily with others, exchanging with others. That when you get a mixed system, you get half or more of the transactions basically being mandated or regulated or you know, distorted and twisted by government manipulations of money and credit and government manipulations of regulations and tax rates and things, all that part of the burgeoning welfare state.
Can I just say that I think, you know, my big issue is with people passively earning things. I'm not a big fan of passive income. Yep. And
I've heard that before, and I reject that idea. But it's a very Marx and Keynes themselves said, nobody should be able to earn money with money. So they have this idea that if you accumulate capital and you accumulate savings, you know, from your prior production, that, you know, unless you're working and sweating and laboring with your muscles every day, you don't get to keep any of that. You don't get to earn money by lending out your capital to others. You don't get to make any money by, you know, renting your apartments out to renters and things. To me, that's that part of the private ownership of the means of production, control of, yeah, once you accumulate assets, of course you should be able to rent those assets to others for a fee. And that's, it's weird because that's considered passive, meaning it goes back to the labor theory of value saying, hey, you're just sitting there managing an investment portfolio. You're not digging ditches or you're not working on an assembly line sweating. You know, they said this about Romney when he was running in 2012. They said, how can he just sit there and earn dividends, interest, and income, you know, off his portfolio? The answer is because it's his wealth and it's invested, meaning lent to others who are themselves engaged in productive activity. So the idea of, you know, passive, the IRS treats income this way too. They'll say this is passive income and they'll call it unearned income. So interest, dividends, capital gains are considered unearned. And what's considered earned? Wages and tips and things like that. It's a very labor theory of value approach to income. But the activity or passivity of someone, the demand for them to be active, laboring, muscular, sweating, or else they didn't earn it, is very labor theory of value. It's a very crude pre-1700s view of how wealth is created.
There is an active
Sorry, we've got to get to some of these other questions. As somebody who has passive, and not really passive, because I put a lot of work into it, income from Airbnb, from renting my house out for shoots, you know, there's these innovations that have allowed so many homeowners to be able to rent out their property. And also, you know, if you have been successful and you're able to invest in, somebody has a good idea, hey, I'm Jad Massad and I got a new platform where people in India and all over the world are going to be able to learn how to code. And hey, Mark Andreessen, will you give me some income, your capital to invest? And hey, Peter Thiel, and those guys are going to get, you know, big streams of passive income. But without it, those enterprises wouldn't come to fruition. So, all right, we got a few more people. I want to also welcome, of course, our wonderful Professor Jason Hill to the stage. Thanks for stopping by. Alan, you have a question?
Yeah, I think that brings us to the good hopping off point to... it seems that comparing the left and the right, that the left really has, in terms of the political discourse, captured the market on the moral argument, or what I call the fluffy kitten narrative, which is essentially, you know, the left says, oh, look at that little fluffy kitten. It's poor and defenseless. We have to do something now about it. And if you don't agree with that, then you must be a bad person. How could you not want to help that kitten? Obscuring the fact that, that the government may or may not be the best way to do it. To help that particular cause, and that there may be other more efficient ways to do that. So you see that all the time, whether it be welfare or, you know, even in foreign policy, what I'm seeing a lot of when it comes to Ukraine is, oh, the poor Ukrainian people, as the United States needs to help them because they are poor and defenseless against this huge country, Russia.
And
I'm wondering, so I'm wondering how that political messaging seems to be lost, and how can that be sold in terms of what people were talking about earlier? In terms of promoting libertarianism.
Well, to me, it's the only solution to that is not primarily focusing on libertarianism, but focusing on rational egoism. Because the problem you're talking about is widespread acceptance of the idea that altruism is a moral virtue or a morally virtuous approach. That has to be rejected, but on the grounds of being more positive than negative, people have to say, no, our ethic is rational self-interest, egoism, pursuit of happiness, if you will. That's the American kind of expression of rational egoism, I think. And altruism, people have to realize, is not just being kindly toward those in need. Altruism emphasizes victimology, emphasizes need, emphasizes and preoccupied with suffering. And it is the entire basis, not just of the burgeoning welfare state, which itself is an abomination, but it's the underlying ethic of really serious forms of collectivism, like socialism and fascism, which have murdered and maimed and impoverished literally hundreds, tens of millions of people. So why that's considered furry kitty stuff, I don't know. People either don't know the history of altruism in practice, or they just think it still means kindliness. But that's the only solution. It's not just leave me free. That's part of it. If you want to just go on a very superficial level, whenever you get a claim like this or a call like this, all you have to do is say, you are perfectly free in a capitalist economy to give to voluntary private charity. It's got nothing to do with me. If this is a cause for you, if you feel someone's in need through no fault of their own or whatever, go ahead. But the minute you start holding a gun to the head of others and saying they must support your little furry kitty project, I don't know why anyone would see that as moral. I don't know why anyone would get away with any kind of reputation that said, look how moral I am. I'm forcing everybody else to give to my special cause. I do agree with you, by the way, on what's happening with Ukraine. I don't think we should be helping Ukraine, but I do think they're getting a help. They're getting support on these altruistic grounds. Look how much they're suffering. Therefore, we should do something for them. Well, what if they're suffering on their own account? They didn't provide for their own national defense. Yes, so they're suffering, but what's it got to do with us?
Thanks, Richard. Okay. Just time check here. We've got 8 more minutes. We have, of course, Professor Hill. I don't know if he had a question or if he is just keeping us company as he's grading papers, but of course, he's always welcome and invited to unmute if he can. Otherwise, I'm going to go to Ben.
Yeah, question. For Richard, thinking about some things in the news lately and some large, very large, you know, famous multinational corporations that control areas like e-commerce or communications, what do you think about when those groups start to have powers that could resemble more of an authoritarian sovereignty versus a company and actually start to deteriorate freedom from what I would like to imagine a small colonial village of people trading equitably with each other?
Well, Ben, I'm in the camp that says they're no danger at all. By the way, one of the best interviews on this Jennifer gave recently with Robbie Suave on this. He has some really good answers on this. He specializes in media and stuff like that. I do not believe the quote-unquote tech giants like Facebook and others are squelching people's freedom. I do believe they act stupidly sometimes, and I wouldn't use the word censor, but shut down voices that, you know, they shouldn't be doing, but that's their business model. And you don't have to go on any of those sites. You don't have to pay. I don't think anybody has to pay anything for those sites. It's basically an advertised driven thing. And I'm impressed by the fact that there's been pushback in recent years to the point of people developing alt tech, I guess it's called, alternative platforms and media. Now they're still growing, but it reminds me, by the way, of the 90s when people were complaining that there were only 3 networks and PBS and they were all left-leaning. Well, then someone like Murdoch started Fox. Now, Fox is considered the devil today by other media outlets, but that's the solution to the problem. The solution is go build your own media. If you think Facebook and Google and Twitter and other things are non-objective then or oppressive, create your own platforms. And I think that is being done. As long as we have a capitalist system, that's more likely to be done. I also agree with Robbie. He had a very controversial point about not repealing, I think it's called Section 230 of the Telecom Act of 96. I do think that that's not a special favor to grant immunity to those platforms, not being able to sue, for example, Facebook, because some crazy person goes on and defames someone on Facebook. If you go on Facebook and defame someone, you should be sued. But the idea of suing Facebook is the equivalent of suing a gun manufacturer because some guy misuses the gun. So just some thoughts there. We should be a lot more confident about the ability to express our views on alternative forums and to build alternative forums. There's a lot of people in the liberty movement who are you know, tech savvy and wealthy and stuff, and they're beginning to do things as alternatives.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you.
And Ben, I put the link up there to that interview. I do think you raised some interesting points, particularly now that we see the current government and regime pressuring companies to change their policies and pressuring companies to censor. So at that point, you know, this line of whether or not it's actual censorship or or if it's a private company doing it, I do think it becomes a little bit more complicated. But anyway, we've got another 4 minutes. And Damien, welcome back. Oh, Jason, did you have something to add?
Yeah, today's my teaching day, but I had to cancel classes because of a horrific migraine. So I was able to just jump in. I just wanted to ask Richard a very, very brief question. That is following Rand's argument that taxes in and of themselves are inappropriate, but given the fact that we do need government and we do need to finance the government, if you did a sort of qualitative analysis of all forms of taxation, you know, property tax, sales tax, income tax, my sense is that the most pernicious form of taxation would be the income tax, because it's sort of penalizing you for the translation of your values into concrete form. I was wondering if you were to sit down and do an analysis of the different forms of taxation, what would your position be on that? And what do you think about the abolition of the income tax?
Well, I think I agree with you on the income tax. It's pretty bad in that regard, because you're, yes, expressing your values and creating values. I think the cruelest tax that I've ever seen is the estate tax. So the idea of taxing people who their entire life have earned income and it's been taxed and they've saved it anyway and invested it, and now they're trying to pass it on to heirs or to donor to endowments and things like that. It's so cruel to just steal that money at the end of their life. I would say that the least onerous tax is one where you can decide to pay it. So that's what would be called a consumption tax or a retail tax, where you pay it only when you buy retail goods. But to reduce or get rid of the income tax today, you would have massive deficit spending unless you reduced government spending along with it. So I'm not against, pari passu reducing both of them dramatically, but you'd need a philosophic revolution to shrink the size and scope of government spending, you know, before you just go in and cut taxes. So I'm a supply sider, but one of the things I disagree with about supply siders is their view is cut taxes everywhere and always, no matter what else is going on. And so they are reluctant to go to spending reduction and things like that. But it may be just like in the 2 minutes we have, just to throw out that an entire new session could be done on this, Jason, but I actually have a different view in the objectivist community, and I don't actually think it's inconsistent with Rand's view, but it might be. I don't think taxation is theft. I think taxation is seen as theft only because the government is so huge and is engaged in improper things. But I believe, as long as we're not anarchists, and we're not, as long as we believe government should exist, and we do, but then also as long as we believe the government should only do a fixed range of things having to do with defending individual rights, I think once you have that kind of government, people should finance it. And I'm even willing to say people should be compelled to finance it, because if they're not, they're basically free, what's called free riding. They're basically freeloaders. They're what Ayn Rand would call moochers. And but that troubles some objectivists or libertarians, because it sounds like they're being compelled. But if you look at it the other way, they're compelling others to provide them with a government protection that they didn't pay for. So I know that's a brief answer. It won't convince a lot of people, but we could do a whole session on that, whether even in a free ideal society, how do you finance the government?
That's a good one. We should do a session on, is taxation theft?
Yeah.
So here we are at 2:00. I absolutely have a hard stop, so I'm going to hop. Damien, apologies. Thank you for coming, though. Always love seeing you in the room. And we are going to have plenty of chances to get to your question and others next week. We have Wow. Yeah, we have three clubhouses. We have on Monday, Jason Hill is going to be doing the first of a two-part series on Ayn Rand and sex. Then on Wednesday, Rob Trusinski will do an Ask Me Anything. No, that's on Tuesday. Okay. Then on Wednesday, Jason's going to be doing the second part of his series on Ayn Rand and sex, including covering same-sex love and relationships. I have got as well the Atlas Society Asks interview that day with Kenny Zhu, who has been on the forefront of fighting back against race-based admissions, particularly in the Ivy League, and the particular burden that places on high-achieving Asian students. So it's going to be a busy week, and I'm looking forward to seeing you guys back here next week. So see you, and thank you. Thanks, Richard. Thanks, Roger.
Thank you all. Great questions. Thank you all very much.